Hello, I'm Kate Swanell, and you're listening to the MJA podcast. Today, we're going out of this world for a conversation about how human lungs operate in partial or no gravity, that is to say, in space. One of the world's leading experts on this topic is New Zealander G. Kim Prisk, who is Emeritus Professor at the University of California, San Diego. Kim has worked with shuttle crew members and astronauts who have spent long periods of time on board the International Space Station. I'm delighted to have him as my special guest today. All right, let's talk about the lung and how it operates in space. How does gravity affect the way a lung functions?
The easiest way to think about it, I think, is with a simple model. Mm-hmm. And I like simple models. So to me, a slinky spring is a great model. If you hold a slinky spring up and stretch it a bit, the coils at the top of the spring are far apart, and
yep.
The coils at the bottom of the spring are close together, and that's because the spring deforms under its own weight. Now, if you were to magically turn off gravity, those coils would all be the same distance apart. And that's pretty analogous to the lung. Mm-hmm. The alveoli at the top of the lung are big, the alveoli at the bottom of the lung are small because the lung deforms under its own weight. Similarly, the blood flows through the walls of the alveoli. That's how gas exchange occurs.
Right.
So there's more blood flow at the bottom of the lung than there is at the top of the lung. There are also hydrostatic effects, John West's Zone 1-2-3 model, that also results in more blood flow being at the bottom of the lung, all of those being in one gravity. Again, if you turn off gravity, put somebody in space, for example, then blood flow is much more uniform and ventilation is much more uniform.
All of which suggests that the lungs love having no gravity.
Yeah, although surprisingly, and it was a surprise to us when mm-hmm. we first did this in some space shuttle flight, the lung actually performs about the same in terms of gas exchange in microgravity and weightlessness as it does here on the Earth.
Okay.
So it's actually pretty well designed. And the reason for that is, gets back to that slinky spring I was talking about, the blood flow and the ventilation are inextricably coupled to each other
right.
through the structure of the lung.
Does the lung function about the same in space immediately, or is there a little lag time for it to adjust?
It turns out that it's pretty much immediate. Again, I keep using the slinky spring, but that slinky spring deforms very quickly, and your lung does the same thing. In fact, there were plenty of useful studies done in parabolic flight where you only get 25 seconds of weightlessness.
Yep.
And those actually show remarkable similarity, for the most part, to those done in sustained weightlessness in spaceflight.
Does coming back to Earth, coming back to 1G, cause a problem?
That's a really good question, because if you look at various organ systems, and I'm mm-hmm. thinking cardiovascular, bone, skeletal muscle, particularly weight-bearing skeletal muscle, all of those organ systems show significant dysfunction on return to 1 gravity. And in fact, that was one of the questions we had when we did experiments on the space station.
Yes.
We had people in space flight for about 6 months, and we were interested in how their lung would adapt to space flight. We knew it changed. We knew that from the early shuttle flight, short-duration flight. But how did it do when it came back? And it turns out the remarkable result, and it was remarkable to me, was that within a week of being back, having been away in space for 6 months in an environment your lung had never seen, it was back to normal. It was
yeah.
as if you never left. So either the lung is a really clever organ or it's really stupid, and I'm not sure what the right answer there is.
Let's talk about gas exchange. How does that change under different gravity conditions?
We know that gas exchange is significantly impaired if you get into high-gravity environments.
Mm.
And for instance, I'm talking about high-performance jet aircraft, for example, where high G-loads are incurred. And that's because the lung does deform under its own weight. If you turn up gravity, so to speak, or
yep.
turn up the acceleration that looks like gravity, the lung deforms even more. And what happens is that the blood really ends up being in a different place to where the ventilation is occurring. And then gas exchange gets really rather poor. However, you turn it around and you go into space, it actually does perfectly fine.
If lungs perform pretty well, in what circumstances during a space mission would it not be quite so perfect? For example, in an extravehicular mission, for example. What's going on
right.
there that makes the lungs a little bit less efficient?
One of the questions we had when we did the experiments on the space station was how does the lung perform following extravehicular activity after a spacewalk? And the reason we had that question was spacesuits operate at a very low pressure. If you pressurized a spacesuit to one atmosphere, which is what the space station operates at, you wouldn't be able to move in the spacesuit. You couldn't do any work. And clearly that's not useful from an operational standpoint. So what we were interested in is, does the decompression stress that results from going from the one atmosphere pressure inside space station to the approximately one-third atmosphere inside a suit, does that decompression stress result in venous gas emboli, the formation of bubbles, and ultimately in decompression illness? And those venous gas emboli, if they are generated, get filtered by the lungs and act as microemboli. You disrupt pulmonary gas exchange, and that's been shown in ascent from deep dives, for example. We looked at pre-post-EVA, pre-post spacewalk lung function, and found, in fact, that the day following a spacewalk, the lungs were just every bit as good as they were before they went outside. Okay. In other words, there was no lasting negative consequence from a spacewalk, which implies that even if the venous gas emboli are formed, and there's evidence that they are, the effect is not lasting. And so from an operational standpoint, that becomes important because we know that we're not disrupting the lungs. Now, that belies a problem, which is, in order to do a spacewalk from space station, from the time you say, I think I'm going to pop outside, to the time you get to open the hatch is 4 hours.
Right.
You go through a long denitrogenation process, which is akin to coming up from a deep dive, staging in a scuba expedition. That process takes about 4 hours. And if you're talking about going to the moon, where mission models call for an EVA every day of the week, five days a week.
That's a lot of hours.
That's a huge mission overhead. That's 20 hours. And clearly that's not a good look. The answer to that is modifying the habitat. You're building a habitat for the moon, for the lunar surface.
Mm-hmm.
Build, what do you want to build?
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't have to be the same as here on Earth. And so what the likely lunar habitat will be is about half an atmosphere at 32% oxygen. That's the approximate numbers. And that reduces the time thinking you'll go outside to the time you open the hatch from about 4 hours to about 15 minutes, which is acceptable. That's a pretty good gain.
Are there any downsides to living in that kind of atmosphere permanently, though?
Well, we don't really know. People live at altitude, certain, although half an atmosphere is getting a little bit low. That's the equivalent, for the units, 18,000 feet. But we don't believe there's any major deleterious effects. We know that one of the exposures that was done in the 1970s was in Skylab, which had a very strange atmosphere. Skylab had an atmosphere of a third of an atmosphere in round figures and was 70% oxygen.
Whoa.
And that did cause some changes in lung function. It was like that because Skylab was built in the upper stage of a rocket, and rocket fuel tanks are actually extremely fragile things. You couldn't pressurize it to a high pressure. So that did cause some changes that were thought to be due to the development of atelectasis from the high oxygen fraction. However, we're not talking about that sort of fraction. We're talking about 32%, and that's a mildly hypoxic environment. It's the equivalent to close to 2,200 meters or somewhere about there, which is the same altitude that you can expose people to in civil aviation inside the cabin of an aircraft.
Okay.
That was a compromise between reducing the pressure as much as we could to get to a short decompression time, not making them too hypoxic, and not raising the fire risk, which is a big issue in terms of anything over above about 30% oxygen. People get very upset. And things burn very well in that sort of atmosphere. And NASA clearly don't like that.
I'm chatting today with Emeritus Professor G. Kim Prisk about human lungs in space. His narrative review on the subject can be found at mja.com.au. If you're a space nerd like me, check out nasa.gov. They even have ringtones. Back to our chat.
So the lung's doing pretty well with most situations right now.
That's what we think.
So in your paper, you talk about the biggest challenge you think being dust, which sounds so everyday.
It does sound so everyday. It's the most prosaic of problems.
Yes.
But, you know, if you go back to the Apollo era and the debriefs from the 6 lunar landings that occurred, a universal complaint in every mission debrief was that damn dust. It's extremely fine-grained, and if you look at, there's an iconic photograph of Armstrong's boot print on the lunar surface, and that tells you actually a huge amount about the dust on the lunar surface, because that boot print has exquisite detail. It's extremely fine-grained. I mean, it's finer grained than a bag of cement, for example. It sticks to the suits. When they come inside, they're protected in a suit, that's fine, but it's when they come inside that the problems occur, because they've got to take the suit off. So they track the dirt inside. And, you know, Mum said, wipe your feet when you come inside. She was right, but it takes a bit of effort to do that when you're in a spacesuit. And so the dirt is tracked inside. And, you know, I mean, I was talking with Jack Schmidt, who was the second to last man on the moon. He was on Apollo 17. He said, when you took your helmet off, it smelt like somebody had fired a gun inside the cab. This very acrid smell. And the dust is important because it is likely somewhat toxic. Yep. We know a lot about lunar dust in that it's been studied extremely well, and there's been some very good toxicological studies on it over out of Johnson Space Center. And we know that it's not totally innocuous, neither is it as nasty as fresh fractured quartz. Crystalline quartz from the fresh fractured state is extremely toxic, well-known occupational hazard. It's not that bad, but the trouble is that the dust that's been studied has been exposed to an atmosphere before it got studied. Now, on the moon, there is no atmosphere. And so, although the dust might have been generated millions of years ago by micrometeorites impacting the lunar surface, it might as well have been generated today, because there's no atmosphere and there's no water there to chemically passivate the surface activity of the dust. And so one of the concerns that we have is that the fresh fractured dust may in fact be considerably more toxic or have considerably more toxicological potential than the aged dust that has been studied. That's a speculation at this point in time. However, it's not trivial to deal with. And this all comes down to the cost, and I'm not talking just about dollars there, but the mission cost of dealing with the dust. If the stuff is extremely toxic, then you have to put a lot of effort into it, into not breathing it. If it's just so-so, then you can drop that effort back a bit. Spaceflight isn't a business of limited resources, and if you do one thing, you trade it off for another. And so understanding the mission cost of a toxic or more or less toxic dust becomes actually rather important. Those are still open questions. Nobody's been able to study pristine dust, unfortunately.
Does dust deposit differently in a lung that's under less gravitational effect?
That is a potentially important point as well. We've done a lot of studies looking at aerosol transport and deposition in the lung, where we use not dust, but inert polystyrene latex particles. And we've done those under different G levels in research aircraft. This allows us to, we don't need to go to space to do that sort of thing. We can do it in the microgravity
comet.
Research aircraft. The Vomit Comet, aptly named, I might mention.
Yes.
We won't go there. And those studies show that while less dust deposits in the lung in low gravity, which is a good thing, the dust that does deposit does so more peripherally in the lung, out towards the alveoli.
And that's important in terms of clearance, isn't it?
Absolutely. The mucociliary clearance system deals with particles very effectively in the central and larger airways. And the effectiveness of that system falls off as you move towards the lung periphery. And so the residence time of particles increases as you deposit them more peripherally. And so you're faced with the challenge of depositing less, which is a good thing, but having what you deposit hang around longer, which is a bad thing.
Yes.
The balance between those two, we don't know. You know, a lot of it is you make a conservative estimate of deposition, and you make a conservative estimate of the toxicity, and then just try to play a reasonable exposure game.
Are you confident that, given the imperatives of going beyond the Earth, that we'll solve these problems pretty easily? Or, well, easily, you know what I mean. We'll solve these problems inevitably as we go along?
Yeah, well, they'll mitigate them. I mean, the reality is that anybody going to space knows, it's not exactly risk-free. This is just another risk, and the key here is managing risk and trying to do so in a thoughtful fashion. You can, if you wish, almost eliminate the risk of dust, but it would take a huge amount of effort to do so. And again, it comes back to the issue of then limited resources. How much time and effort do you need to put into decontaminating your spacesuit before you can take your helmet off? Those are the sort of questions that have to be made, and all you can do is try to make reasonable risk assessment and then move on. None of this is risk-free.
If someone said to you, Kim, we need you to go on a lunar mission tomorrow, would you go?
Where do I sign?
You've got one of the coolest jobs. Just the ability to have a conversation with an Apollo astronaut would just blow my mind. Thank you, Kim. That was
all right.
Fascinating.
Well, nice to talk with you.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
Okay, pleasure.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.